A pack of wolves watched from nearby. The narrator was unmoved.
Tar deaths often occurred in clusters. A single animal's cries might attract predators such as these dire wolves.
She remembered the film from early trips to the museum. It had been a heady time for her and her brother, when the dream of stable childhoods had at last come true. In fact, wasn't it here at this very museum that their new parents had asked Hazel and Gregory to think of them as grandparents, even though they were officially adopting them as their own? Isaac had said,
"We're too old to be new parents. Grandma and Grandpa, it just feels right."
Later, Hazel wondered if this decision hadn't been a kind of nod to Tom as their one-time father of sorts. Whatever his misdeeds, Isaac and Lily's addict son had brought the four of them together.
The wolves on screen were in trouble. "These predators are walking into the same trap that befell the horse."
Despite the relative happiness of those museum outings with Isaac and Lily, the idea that these prehistoric animals just sat in a pool of tar, waiting to die, had always terrified her. She'd become familiar on those trips with the phrase, "dying of exposure," which sounded to her like the worst fate imaginable. It had also brought to mind her brother in that closet, and the sickening question, "Can one die of exposure trapped not in tar, but inside a house?" The drama on screen was doing nothing to quell her anxiety. She turned and studied the room. In the glow of the projection, Hazel could see a group of well-behaved schoolchildren seated in the back, an alert teacher posted beside them. A young couple in the row behind her couldn't contain their giggling, presumably at the film's mossy animation. A family of five was seated in her own row, all looking unimpressed. She didn't spot anyone who looked like an enigmatic professor with an appointment.
The soundtrack swelled to distortion. "And this process over thousands of years preserved the bones in excellent condition, allowing visitors of the George C. Page Museum to marvel at these fascinating creatures. Enjoy your visit."
As the house lights came up and the theater emptied, Hazel remained in her seat. She studied the museum map, keeping her body angled toward the entrance. When the last of the children had filed out, she heard a voice behind her. His accent was thick, Spanish or Italian.
"May I compliment you on your scarf?"
She glanced over to find a spectacled man of late middle age seated in her row, the father of that family. Or had he only been sitting next to them? In his browned windbreaker and leather sandals, he looked like a European on vacation. Hazel looked around to see if the man wasn't addressing someone else, but they were alone.
"It really is a nice scarf," he tried again.
"I'm not wearing a scarf." Her hand went to her neck for confirmation.
"Herringbone, isn't it? My favorite."
Herringbone. She looked at him sharply. "Mr. Richardson?"
"Miss Severy?"
The lights cut out, and his face vanished. Music swelled as the opening credits for the next show began.
"Or is it Raspanti?" she asked over the soundtrack. "Yes, I hope the late Mr. Richardson doesn't mind my borrowing his name. I'm trying to keep a low profile while I'm in the States."
"Are you even a professor?"
"I prefer mathematician. But yes, I teach at the Polytechnic University in Milan."
"So why are you here?" The screen cut to black, and the film's narration started.
"Imagine Los Angeles thousands of years ago."
His voice called from the dark.
"Meet me near the sloths."
When the screen lit up again, the doors were gently swinging, and Raspanti was gone. Hazel left the theater and walked deeper into the museum. She hesitated in front of the long-limbed skeleton of Nothrotherios shustensis, the giant prehistoric sloth. There was a large illustration of the beast on the wall, its lummox's face staring out in a plea for its own extinction. Just as Hazel was wondering if all this subterfuge was necessary, she turned to find Raspanti standing on the other side of the skeleton, peering into the blind cavities of its skull. He was quite tall, with a sharp Roman profile, like something straight off an ancient bas-relief. She understood at once that this was the man she had seen lurking that day at Isaac's gravesite.
"Unfortunate-looking animal," he said, pulling up the collar of his jacket, as if he believed himself to be wearing a trench coat and not a windbreaker.
In sympathy of the chill, she wrapped her cardigan more snugly around her, unsure where to begin her line of questioning. Raspanti leaned in a little, smelling faintly of tobacco and foreign hygiene products.
"Isaac said you would make contact, but I was becoming impatient. He also said you would have something for me."
Hazel hesitated. "An equation, you mean?" He smiled tightly and glanced over one shoulder.
"Quiet, please, Miss Severy."
"Even if I did have it," she said, dropping her voice, "how do I know you're the one I'm supposed to give it to?"
"You'll think I'm an impostor."
He let the accusation hang in the air for a moment.
"If the watchword isn't enough for you, it shouldn't be too difficult for you to confirm who I am."
As he started to turn away, she stopped him.
"I searched John Raspanti. No mathematics professors came up."
He nodded in understanding.
"Your grandfather doesn't like to make things easy, does he?"
"He liked to call me John. But it's John with a G. Giancarlo."
Raspanti walked off, stopping a few yards away at the diorama of a Colombian mammoth, one of Hazel's favorite exhibits. The animatronics beneath its matted fur would jerk to attention every few minutes, accompanied by a faraway roar. She pulled out her phone and entered his full Italian name into a search engine. Up popped a portrait of Raspanti on the Milan Polytechnic site. There was also a group photo from a mathematics summit, men and women arranged Solvay conference style, with Raspanti towering next to her grandfather, an arm thrown around his shoulders. These were younger Raspantis, but clearly the same man who stood in front of her now. She stepped over to the diorama.
"Why didn't Isaac just give you the equation himself?"
Raspanti blinked rapidly.
"You think I don't ask the same question? You think I had any idea he was going to do that to himself? What I know is I get a letter in the mail one day, telling me he is leaving his life's work to me, so that they won't get their hands on it. He told me you would be the courier."
"Well, he could have sent you an email attachment and saved me the trouble."
The man frowned.
"They would be looking for that. Phones are equally unsecure."
"Who's they?"
The mammoth rattled to life.
"They are always the same. One of two groups who enjoy exploiting science for their own ends. The first group uses scientific advancement as a tool for war. The other wants to make more money than they already have. One kills, the other steals. If either group gets a hold of Isaac's work, it would be, well, regrettable."
Raspanti dropped his voice to a near whisper.
"The equation is just the beginning, a seed for chaotic prediction. Can you imagine if the government had a formula to predict anything it wanted? Or Wall Street? You think they are going to share this formula with people like you and me?"
"So it is a predictor.
Of a very specific kind."
"Then why not destroy the whole thing and be done with it?"
"Should we scrap particle physics because it produced the H-bomb?"
His voice dropped again.
"There is value in the equation, even if we don't use it to forecast the future. All brilliant math has jewels locked inside it that can be harnessed. When Andrew Wiles proved Fermat's last theorem in 1994, he did so on the backs of other great theorems. I have a German colleague who coined a term for the phenomenon, Genie Schultern, on the shoulders of genius. And so it goes, on and on."
"That's fine, Mr. Raspanti, but it doesn't really matter because I don't have the equation."
"Or you have it and don't know where to look."
She wondered if she should hand over the contents of the hotel room to him. "Here, you figure it out." Even though Isaac had expressly asked her to destroy everything. But then where was this alleged equation if not on the computer or the map?
The map.
She pulled out her phone and swiped through the images she had snapped on her trip. A wide shot of the Beechwood house, her old bedroom, Drew smelling a flower, Gregory frowning at her. But the photos she was looking for were not there. She searched the trash. Gone. Feeling suddenly unsteady, she leaned on a nearby panel display for support.
Is something wrong? Raspanti asked. I took photos of his map, 4 of them, but they're gone.
A map? Raspanti said in a loud whisper. With specific points predicting events down to the day and minute.
She looked up. How did you know?
He showed me a similar map in Milan, a kind of test run. He was anticipating events there like a seismologist predicts earthquakes.
Raspanti shook his head.
No, like a seismologist wishes he could predict earthquakes.
And by events you mean... Raspanti didn't answer. He was staring at the mammoth again. Isaac's own death was on the map, she continued, and my cousin's who died in a recent accident. He turned sharply.
Isaac's death was on the map?
Yes, it is a death map, isn't it? Raspanti grabbed his head, as if reevaluating everything.
No, no. Your grandfather wasn't just predicting any kind of death. That would have been too broad.
Pointless, even. People die every day in the most unremarkable ways.
Then what?
Can't you guess?
She could, but she didn't want to say it out loud because it was too heavy, too terrifying. She wanted this all to be over so she could go home.
The joints of the ancient elephant began to grind and shift, and when the animal thundered to life again, she said,
I have something to show you.
30 minutes later, with Raspanti right behind her, Hazel unlocked room 137. As she pushed open the door and led him down the hall, she knew something was off. She took one step into the living room and stopped. The computer was gone. The map was gone. Otherwise, the room appeared untouched. There were no overturned tables or tossed sofa cushions, just the quiet absence of her grandfather's work. Raspanti glanced around, unsure of what he was supposed to be looking for. Hazel stared at the now blank wall and swallowed hard, not wanting to see what she was seeing.
It was all here, she said finally. No one else had the key.
The Italian ran a hand through his hair, suddenly understanding. He moved to the window leading to the roof. How difficult would it be to break in? Hazel flushed. There was only one other person who knew about the room. She couldn't bring herself to admit what a moron she'd been that night. Drunk, giddy, and foolish. Raspanti instinctively moved to the spot where the computer had been.
What's this?
She joined him at the desk and looked down. In the center of the glass-topped oak sat a shaggy white wig and mustache. They appeared not to have been carelessly left behind, but to have been placed there, deliberately. The mustache was turned upside down in the shape of a smile.
Looks like Einstein left his calling card, Raspanti said sourly.
Twain, she corrected him. Mark Twain. Chapter 19. The Offer. On Saturday morning, Philip drove Silas and Sydney to their tennis lesson and forced himself to sit courtside through the entire instruction. Though he had found excuses to slip away to Anitka's cottage every day for the past week, he had recently made a point to be more present for his sons. Philip tried to concentrate on the boys' practice, but he had taken 2 of his emergency Vicodin at breakfast on top of his migraine medication, and was now feeling a bit high. So while he appeared to be studying the twins and their sylph-like instructor, he was really seeing Anitka's figure spring about the court, dark hair catching auburn highlights in the sun. Anitka didn't even play tennis, but he actually clapped after watching his lovely phantom slice a drop shot that Silas couldn't return. He stopped clapping when he looked across the court and swore he saw Nellie Stone in the bleachers. She was sitting next to a large man whose face, masked in shadow, Philip couldn't quite make out. When he blinked, and they both disappeared, he promised himself he'd cut back on the pills. Afterward, Philip treated his sons to their favorite ice cream parlor. Between bites of banana split, Philip realized Silas and Sydney were staring at him.
What? You're being kind of weird, Dad.
Just tired, he said, trying his best not to sound drug-addled. How do you like your new instructor?
She's fine, they replied together.
Philip almost said,
Well, she's certainly fit, but realized that this would sound creepy. Besides, his sons didn't appear to notice female beauty, and Philip was imagining the day when they would announce in unison that they preferred men. He had already prepared himself for the expression of unfaltering acceptance he would wear on his face. And at that moment, watching them scoop mint chip ice cream into their mouths, he felt that he wanted nothing more than their happiness, whatever their preferences, academic or otherwise. He wondered if this feeling would last. The family reconvened for a late lunch at home, where Philip's medicated high turned to anxiety. Anitka texted him several times that afternoon, and he had to repeatedly excuse himself in order to peck out a reply. After Jane commented on his multiple trips to the bathroom, he mumbled something about indigestion and retreated upstairs to delete both ends of the exchange. Around 4:30, the house phone rang. It was Kimiko Kato calling with an arcane question about a certain five-dimensional manifold Philip used in his work. Her query didn't have an easy answer, thereby giving him the perfect cover to step out for a couple of hours. After he hung up, he had to suppress a smile as he told his family that he needed to catch up with the group. Faye, detecting his eagerness to leave, questioned him.
The group, huh?
Yeah.
All men?
One woman, Japanese, one of the best physicists in the world.
She sniffed.
You're not just saying that in the way men like to pat women on the back.
We do allow women to be great scientists now and then.
Faye asked if he could drop her off at the grocery store on the way. Philip agreed, though he had some difficulty concealing his irritation. As they headed out the door, he cast a final glance back into the house and saw Jane watching him from the staircase, a thin smile on her face. He tossed her a mock salute before pulling the door shut, and for the next 15 minutes her smile seemed tethered to him. He was so distracted by it, and by the idea that the smile had meant something, that he could barely maintain his end of the conversation with Faye in the car.
So where is this group going?
Just a lounge on campus.
So you're like beer buddies, but instead of sports and girls, you talk about the meaning of the universe.
Well, I don't know about meaning. He turned into the Ralph's grocery store parking lot.
If you were to eavesdrop, it wouldn't sound as important as all that.
Please, it's called the theory of everything, isn't it?
A slight exaggeration.
A self-satisfied smile spread across her face.
You know what I think?
He was so unnerved by how much she looked like Jane in that moment that he found himself unable to respond.
I think you're one of those men who's important enough to be able to downplay the value of his own work, but you know full well how valuable it is. I bet you think there's no work in the world more important than yours.
He wasn't prepared for this level of psychological dissection coming from his sister-in-law.
I'm on to you.
She gathered up her shopping bags.
You should let me join your group sometime.
I might have a thing or two to say about the universe myself. She cackled as if she had said something very clever.
Hey, thanks for doing all this, he called to her as she was getting out. It's because of you that Jane's getting better.
She stuck her head back in the car.
You really think she is?
Don't you?
She shrugged.
You're not around her like I am. I don't blame you for not picking up on the subtleties.
You should have seen her before you arrived.
Faye sighed.
My sister's not like me. She doesn't always let you know what's going on with her.
Thanks for the ride.
She slammed the door and strode with purpose toward the white-hot blaze of the supermarket. As Ralph's receded in his rearview mirror, the image of Jane's smile from the stairs returned, sliding from an innocent expression of trust into an unspoken plea. And as he turned into Anitka's neighborhood, his wife's small mouth transformed into a gaping hollow of despair. And just when it had reached terrifying proportions, the cottage door opened, and the nightmare vanished. He spent the next 2 hours on Anitka's full-sized mattress, the two of them blissfully negotiating its meager expanse. But for Philip, the hours weren't entirely free from worry. His sister-in-law's prying had made him nervous. If he didn't get back in time for dinner, he wouldn't put it past her to check his cover story. Philip quickly showered, dressed, and returned to bed to kiss Anitka goodbye.
Don't go, please.
She pulled him back onto the pillow and pretended to tackle him.
Besides, you never showed me your father's boxes.
He blinked at her in surprise.
Jesus, you really are a fangirl.
You promised.
Did I?
He took her hand and kissed it.
There's nothing to look at, just some books and newspaper clippings.
She propped herself up on one elbow.
Is my interest irritating?
Mildly,
he smiled.
But it'll have to be next time.
She gave him a mock frown and rolled out of bed. As he watched her head to the bathroom, he wondered if anyone would be picking over the remains of his own office when he died, or stalking his family for unpublished gems. Over the aggressive pulse of the showerhead, Philip shouted his goodbye. It was better to make a quick exit. No protracted farewells. But he found it difficult to leave and lingered in the living room. He had not yet spent an entire night at the cottage, though he could have easily come up with a pretext to spend several nights with her. An out-of-town lecture, a last-minute symposium somewhere, a weekend retreat at the Aspen Center. Yet for all his romantic desperation, and the many avenues of deceit open to him, Philip lacked the stomach for such an elaborate lie. He paused at Anitka's bookshelf, running a finger over his father's old publications. Remembering that Anitka had said she'd corrected a mistake somewhere, he pulled the papers one by one from the shelf, and finding one title significantly vandalized with her scrawl, he rolled it up and stuck it in his coat pocket. A second later, the bedroom door opened and she sauntered over, tying on a loose robe. He thought of telling her about the paper, but he was sure she would protest, insisting it was nothing. Instead, he kissed her forehead and said, "I'll see you tomorrow." As he turned to the front door, he noticed that her whiteboard was now blank. No more doodles, no more Fibonacci spiral, just the faint afterimage of marker.
"I decided you were right about that Dirac poem after all," she said, following his gaze. "It really is depressing."
Outside, the Santa Ana winds were coming in cold and strong, and the palm leaves above Philip's head rustled like butcher paper. Something was nagging at him. Was it Anitka's enthusiasm for his father's work? Or was it that he was deceiving his wife in these small, wretched doses? He had parked two blocks away this time in an effort to evade the phantom private eyes his guilty mind imagined were following him, though a block could hardly have made a difference. He followed the chirp-chirp to his Subaru and was just reaching for the door handle when the headlights of a car came on behind him. Philip froze. Oh, it's over now. And as he turned toward the lights, he tried to invent a reason for his being in this neighborhood. A woman called from the car.
"I'm sorry to alarm you, Mr. Severy."
He peered past the light and saw a black sedan sitting there. The slim shadow of Nellie Stone emerged from the back seat.
"Ah," Philip said, relaxing only slightly. "The unrelenting secretary."
"Whenever my phone rings," she said, "I'm always hoping it will be you."
"It never is."
"Flat out stalking, is that what we've come to?"
"You do make me feel like the unhinged girlfriend."
"What do you want, Nellie?"
"The car was just cleaned. We could lean against it and chat."
She called to the driver.
"Arturo, would you kill the lights?"
The headlights promptly dimmed, yielding to the sodium glow of a street lamp. Nellie was wearing a charcoal overcoat and scarf. She was without her glasses, which made her look strangely defenseless, like a nocturnal creature tossed outside at midday. Perhaps the lenses had been masking the hollows of her eyes, for Philip could now see she was not younger than him, but a peer. She reached into her coat for cigarettes and a lighter, extending the pack to Philip as an offering. As he came close, she gracefully hipped the back door shut, and Philip thought he saw movement behind the tinted window. Was it just a play of the light? Photons were certainly crafty things, especially when confronted with glass. One never knew what a particle of light might do to fool the eye. As Philip looked at the dark window, his unease increased.
"Someone with you?"
he asked, selecting a Dunhill. She didn't answer. Instead, she set the end of her cigarette ablaze and did the same for him. The wind picked up, and he inverted the collar of his coat. He wondered if she might suggest the car as shelter from the weather, but she didn't show any signs of discomfort.
I was very sorry to hear about your daughter.
He chose to ignore this.
Did you know there was a recent break-in at my father's old office?
Really?
And for some reason, government scholar relations came to mind.
She shook her head.
It's unrelated, I'm afraid.
Besides, a burglary would have been unnecessary.
Why's that?
GSR is no longer searching for Isaac's work.
Giving up, then?
She smiled.
You can't look for what you've already found.
As she studied his face for a reaction, an alarm sounded deep within Philip, accompanied by the sudden need to protect his father's work, work he still wasn't sure existed.
I'd be happy to explain, she continued, if you would only consider meeting with Mr. Lyons.
Actually, that's not why I'm here.
He checked his watch.
Then you should get to it.
I'm here to recruit you. We'd like you to work for us.
He laughed.
You really are deranged.
Give it some thought.
We pay well, extremely well, in fact.
So you're asking me to leave my position at the university to work for an organization I know nothing about, one that appears to have questionable hiring practices and has quite possibly stolen from my dead father.
All for the paycheck. You think that's what motivates me?
For the intellectual satisfaction, then.
You know my answer.
But you haven't heard the entire question.
She sent a puff of smoke downwind.
I wonder what Anitka Durov would think.
He frowned. What has she got to do with this?
I thought she might have an opinion.
So this is blackmail now.
Please, we're not so classless as that. I'm only trying to get your attention. How about lunch tomorrow?
Take two?
He turned to walk back to his car.
So you have no interest in seeing your father's work?
She shouted above the wind.
He stopped and turned back. I have no interest in being shadowed or contacted repeatedly, or having you know more about my life than my family does. I'd like to be left alone.
What,
so you can slip back into academic obscurity? Let your brain decay while you bed the latest grad student?
She allowed her dunghill to drop, smashing the butt with her shoe.
Or is it that you'd rather not be reminded of your father's legacy when you're struggling so valiantly for a shot at your own?
Philip froze. He felt his anger rising, but could not deny the painful truth of this statement. She went on.
Could it be that you're not an inquisitive person?
Nellie lit another cigarette, the flame of her lighter twitching in the wind.
What about all those questions you had for me that day in Malibu?
You mean the day Lyons stood me up?
Philip shouted. Nellie paused for a reflective moment.
We've been unfair to you, Mr. Severy. I've been unfair to you. And I'd like to make it up to you, if you'll let me.
A staccato buzzing came from her pocket, and her slender hand dove in to silence it.
But it looks like it'll have to be another time.
Short leash?
She gave him a knowing look and pivoted to the car's back door. When she opened it, Philip moved forward to get a better view of the back seat. But he saw that it was empty, just black padded leather and a snakeskin handbag. The only other person in the car was the driver, who made a move for the ignition.
Just a second, Arturo.
Nellie rested her arm on the door and turned to Philip. Do you remember the one question you asked me that I couldn't answer?
Which one was that?
You wanted to know what the P in P. Booth Lyons stood for.
You said you didn't know.
It was probably wrong of me to keep it from you, given how important your father was to us. She snuffed her cigarette in the door's ashtray, and when her hand returned, it was holding a business card, like magic. He would have been no more surprised to see the Queen of Diamonds.
I have one, thanks.
You don't have this one. It's the only one like it in the world. He took the card from her. There was no number or contact information, just a serifed name floating in cream. Penelope Booth Lyons. He frowned, struggling to interpret what he was seeing.
Penelope?
But I prefer Nellie, she said. Fewer syllables. She climbed into the car and pulled the door shut behind her. A second later, The window slid halfway down. So I'll see you tomorrow? No more secrets. I promise. Philip didn't respond. It was as if two incompatible ideas had suddenly catapulted into his brain and were now forced at gunpoint to reconcile. The engine of the town car hummed into action, and the headlights returned. You'll let me know about tomorrow, then. I'm not going to chase you anymore, Philip. When you're ready to see your father's work, you'll tell me. The dark glass of the window gradually eclipsed her assured smile, and when her face had disappeared from view, the car slipped into gear, and the woman who called herself P. Booth Lyons drove away. Chapter 20. The List. It was dusk, and the offices of the Juvenile Protection Unit were nearly empty. From his spot at a window overlooking downtown Los Angeles, Gregory tried to appreciate the twinkling cityscape, how the honeyed glow of sunset could give way so rapidly to night. But he felt uneasy, as if something were about to happen that he couldn't control. Maybe if he looked hard enough he'd be able to pick out Tom's figure below, making its wretched way back to the subway. At some point, he feared, Tom was going to abandon his routine altogether. He might even pick up and move, far from where he could be surveilled. Gregory couldn't allow that to happen. He returned to his desk to gather his things and lock up the cabinets. The coffee he'd poured earlier was now cold. Even so, he picked up a spoon and stirred it absently, imagining that if he moved the spoon counterclockwise for long enough, he might be able to suck the heat back into the mug. Longer still, and the cream would unmix itself and swirl back into the hypnotic pattern it had once made. But there was no fighting the laws of thermodynamics. One couldn't uncool coffee, just as one couldn't unkill a person. EJ paced nearby, wobbling slightly on her heels. Must be date night with her husband. For 19 years, EJ had thrown her life into saving the city's imperiled children, yet despite everything she'd seen in those years, she managed to conduct herself with extraordinary lightness. He had the sense that the second EJ got home to her husband, she could kick off her shoes, let her job roll off her back, and enter into the ease of spousal banter. That's the kind of detective she was. She didn't need to use rage as a release. She didn't need to meet violence with violence, as he did. She could just switch it all off. But these past weeks, EJ had been acting strange. First mothering everyone in the office, and then retreating. Now this emphatic pacing. Her behavior worried him, and he might have asked her about it had he not wanted to invite similar questions about himself. For instance, he'd hardly shown his face at work for the past 2 weeks. If it hadn't been for Hazel catching him in the Cadillac that morning, he'd likely still be sitting there now. EJ caught him looking in her direction. She scratched her scalp with the corner of a lime green folder. You have a second, Greg? He hesitated. Curious though he was, he didn't really have time for a chat. It was his fourth wedding anniversary, and Goldie was preparing a fussy meal that had taken days of planning. She wanted him to be excited about the dinner, though she knew full well that whether it was steak flambé or a ham sandwich, it was all the same to him. Whatever reaction Goldie was looking for, he usually managed to simulate the appropriate response. He was lucky she was rotten at detecting emotional mimicry. What's on your mind, EJ? She zigzagged to his desk and placed in front of him a mug shot of a hollow-cheeked, dead-eyed woman whose gray hair was pulled back from a face that showed no emotion except for the beginnings of a smile. EJ tapped the photo with a lacquered nail. Recognize this harpy? He did. That rubber band crease of a mouth that wanted to stretch into a full smile but settled instead on a smirk. It nauseated him how little shame these criminals displayed on camera. It was the rare mugshot that showed honest disgrace or regret. Most of these people, child molesters, abusers, rapists, held their chins high, as if they had made the decision before the photo was snapped that they were going to retain some motherfucking dignity. Some even smiled, as if looking cheerful were somehow an imaginative response to having been caught doing something deeply horrible. It was the smile of guilt that Gregory had come to know well. The one that said, "Funny how life has led me to this moment, isn't it?" He shrugged.
"They all start to look the same."
She slapped the back of his head. It was supposed to be playful, but it hurt.
"You think I'm an idiot. I know you don't forget." "The Burgess case," he said at last. "Rita? Rhonda?"
"Rhoda. Rhoda Burgess. Wife of that sadistic fuck who kept those kids chained up in his basement?" His gorge rose.
"Sure, he didn't even touch them, as I recall. Just recorded their gradual starvation for some internet racket. Ran the whole thing out of his house in Castle Heights, until someone from the gas company came to check the meter and found a skeleton trying to break out of a basement window."
"Mr. Burgess got life," EJ said, jabbing the photo again.
"While the missus here skipped away scot-free.
Not a day in prison. Claimed she didn't know what hubby was doing down there all those years. Cried and carried on in front of the judge."
"So, what do we have on her?"
"She's dead."
"Even better."
"Died back in August. Took a dive off a downtown overpass. Her head was promptly flattened by a bagel truck."
"Great. Tape a K on her face and put her on the wall with the rest. We owe the driver a drink."
"Don't be patronizing."
"Well, sorry. If I don't get all misty over the suicide of a woman too stupid to realize there was a miniature concentration camp in her basement."
"She didn't kill herself."
"No?"
"A witness came forward. Homeless guy who lives under the overpass says he saw the whole thing. Says the woman was pushed. There's more." EJ lined up the green folder beside Rhoda's photograph and flipped back the cover to reveal at least 10 more mugshots. Gregory sifted through the pile. They were mostly men, a few women. Cases that had appeared on his desk at some point. He knew their faces well. The bad skin, the vacant eyes.
"Looks like our typical deck of cards," he observed.
"Really?"
She pointed across the office to the karma board.
"Half of them have been staring at us for years."
"What are you saying?" he asked.
"All of them are closed cases, some going back 6 years. The thing they all have in common? They all got off easy. Light sentences, acquittals, community service, finger wagging."
"Uh-huh."
"The other thing is that they're all dead."
"Well, some of these guys are pretty old."
"Then I guess old makes you clumsy. This guy drowned in his bathtub. This woman took an accidental overdose of insulin. This one fell off his roof while doing some home improvement."
"So, accidents."
He locked up his desk and stepped toward the window.
"Could it be that you're looking for a pattern where there isn't one? What is coincidence but the concurrence of events?"
"The concurrence of events? You're really going to give me a lecture on probability. I get it, Greg. You come from math people."
"So, out with it. What's your theory?"
She joined him at the window. They were silent for a moment as they looked out toward Parker Center, the old LAPD headquarters. The glass house, as it had been known, was either destined for historical landmark status or demolition, depending whom you asked, and from time to time you could find wistful detectives gazing in the direction of their old, possibly doomed home. "This is serial," she said at last, turning to face him. "The deaths will continue unless we stop it." Her stare was so intense he had to turn away.
"How long have you been looking into this?"
"Since the witness showed up back in September. I wanted to be sure."
"You report this to anyone?"
"Just you." She clicked her tongue against the roof of her mouth the way she sometimes did when she was thinking. "Even if I don't, someone else will make the same connection. Eventually." Gregory ran a hand through his hair.
"Listen, my wife is going to have my head if I don't get home for dinner."
"Go.
And keep this between us?"
He smiled.
"Of course."
"Love to Goldie."
"Same to Cal."
Gregory grabbed his jacket and headed to the elevator. A sign informed him that the elevators were being serviced, so he continued down the hall to the stairwell. As he pushed through the door and rounded the first corner, the image of her came to him, as he knew it would. For the rest of his life, whenever he climbed or descended a set of stairs, he would think of her. It was his punishment, he supposed. Had they stuck to their original plan, to their promise to be together, she wouldn't have fallen down those steps. "I'm leaving Jack," Just days after having written those words, Sybil changed her mind quite suddenly. She had consulted God, prayed a lot, you know? And instead of leaving Jack, they were going to try for another child. We can't do this anymore. You have to stop contacting me, Gregory. This is what she said as they sat together on that blanket in the moonlight. Sybil had agreed to meet him only because it would be their last time together. If they saw each other again, it would have to be as cousins. At first, he didn't respond, as if he hadn't heard her properly. But when he finally spoke, his voice frightened her so much that she flinched. She stood up and went to the edge of the yard overlooking Hollywood, shivering in her thin coat. He followed, unfolding the note she had written him and held it to her face.
"Remember what you said? Why say it if you didn't mean it?"
She shook her head, lashes clotted with tears. She had a daughter to worry about, a daughter who could have died because her mother had been distracted. Too preoccupied with her own selfish emotions to notice that her daughter was shoving poisonous flowers into her mouth. "What kind of example is that, Gregory?" When he told Sybil he wasn't going to give her up just like that, she called him angry and obsessive. She thumped a fist on his chest, and that's when he realized how tightly he was gripping her.
"Just let me go, let me go," she protested.
Instead, he pulled her to him with even more desperation. But when his sweet Sybil said with uncharacteristic bile,
"I'm sick to death of your anger, Gregory, and sick to death of you,"
he suddenly let go. He knew the force with which she was pulling away would send her reeling backward, but as he played the scene over in his mind, the difference between letting go and pushing blurred. Had he really meant for her to tumble backward down those steps? Had he really intended for the person he loved so much to die almost instantly? Yes, perhaps in that moment, that was exactly what he had wanted. As Gregory continued down the stairwell, he felt his stomach lurch at the memory. He slowed and grabbed the banister for fear of falling himself. At the ground floor, he threw open the door and let the cool air hit his face. It was then that he felt tears pooling in his eyes. When he reached the plaza, he blinked back at the building and saw that EJ hadn't moved from the window. She didn't see Gregory pass below. She was still looking in the direction of the glass house, no doubt planning her next move. He would have to act soon with Tom. The days when he might have managed situations like this at his leisure were coming to an end. It was all coming to an end, and the end point was out of his control. All he could do was let the universal computer lead him to it. Chapter 21 The Recluse. Hazel woke the next day with what felt like a hangover, except she was sure that she hadn't drunk anything the night before. She squinted at her surroundings, struggling against an acute sense of disorientation. She was in a tidy, unfamiliar bedroom, but it wasn't her brother's guest room. As her eyes fell on a deco chest of drawers and an Art Nouveau print framed above it, it suddenly hit her. She had spent the night at the hotel. She vaguely remembered having texted Goldie that she was staying out so that she and Gregory could enjoy their anniversary together. At least she'd remembered to do that much. But she couldn't remember having felt this terrible ever, including the time she'd gotten food poisoning in college. Then again, she knew this wasn't physical. This was an emotional illness, which is always worse. She didn't have to look at the clock to know that she'd slept most of the day. Still, when she propped herself up and grabbed her phone from the bedside table, she blinked at it in disbelief. It was 4:15 in the afternoon. Hazel fell back on the pillow and draped an arm across her face to block the light edging in around the blinds. As the events of the previous day came back to her in shaming detail, she groaned aloud and turned into the fetal position.
"Christ, you idiot!"
She could feel the entire weight of her stupidity in her stomach, tightening into a nauseating ball. Hazel shut her eyes tight, and in the darkness behind her lids, Alex's charming smile played for her on repeat. A smile that seemed to say, "You, my friend, have been played."
Alex had most certainly exploited her attraction to him, and by getting caught in his snare, she had failed one of the only people she had loved. What a fool Isaac had been to trust her. Hazel really hoped there was no afterlife because she didn't want her grandfather to see the magnitude of his error. She made a feeble effort to sit up, but the pain of Alex's deceit seemed to be pinning her down. As did Raspanti's admonitions from yesterday. Once he had realized that Isaac's work was missing and that the owner of the wig was responsible, he had said darkly, "You let a man into the room. Let him snoop into your grandfather's math." Isaac should never have left it to you. That much is clear.
"Look, I needed help. And did you seek this man's help? Or did he charm his way into the room?"
When she didn't answer, he said, "I see.
Alex isn't some random stranger. He's my cousin, Isaac's grandson. One with a strong mathematical background, I'm guessing, and oh so very curious about Isaac's work."
That about describes my entire family. Raspanti had calmly picked up the phone, dialed the front desk, and requested that a cab take him to the airport. Hazel then followed him downstairs to the lobby, where she watched him pour himself some drip coffee. She did the same and trailed Raspanti outside. He sat hunched on the front steps, blowing at steam from his cup. She knew he was making a point of not looking at her, which only made her more angry with herself. She sat down and took a sip of coffee. It burned her tongue and she winced. "I screwed up. I know that." Still not looking at her, Raspanti said, "It wouldn't surprise me if these people recruited a Severy mole to poke around Isaac's things, to wait for the equation to show itself. I suppose you didn't have a chance."
"You don't need to make me feel any worse. I already hate myself for failing him." "You think this is a simple failure? A case of family disloyalty?"
He turned, staring her straight in the face.
"It's a disaster on a scale you can't know now, but one day you will. It sounds cruel, but you will read the paper one morning years from now, and you will know what you have done."
Hazel set down her cup and covered her face with her hands. That familiar pressure was building behind her eyes, but she refused to cry. How could it be that Isaac had made her a custodian of such consequence?
"We could find him," she finally said, lifting her head. "We could get the equation back."
Raspanti removed his glasses and pushed at his eyes, as if staving off a headache.
"The equation is gone. Now that they have it, it's theirs forever."
"So you're just going to give up? Go back to Italy?"
"If what you say about the map is true, Isaac was killed for his mathematics. If you think they're just going to hand it back to you, you're delusional."
Hazel's stomach seized. She realized that this was the first time someone had said out loud what she'd been fearing since the moment she'd read the word assassin in Isaac's letter. Isaac was killed for his mathematics. There it was, stated as fact. The taxi arrived. Raspanti stood and went to meet it. Hazel felt desperate to stop him. She felt desperate about a lot of things. About the burden she'd been carrying around for weeks, about the implied murder of her grandfather, and about the fact that she had completely and totally failed him. At that moment, she felt she would do anything to get rid of this awful feeling in her gut.
"What if you're wrong?" she called out just as Raspanti was climbing into the cab. "What if I can get it back?"
He paused.
"If you can get it back," he shouted, "I will personally fly you and the equation to Milan, first class, and I will teach you the meaning of great mathematics. Is that a promise?"
Raspanti laughed bitterly.
"Ciao, Miss Severy."
He shut the door, and the taxi pulled away. Hazel watched until it was out of sight, and when she stood, her legs were shaking. She took a moment to steady herself before returning to the 8th-floor room to stare at the now empty wall. She paced the carpet, ears alert, hoping wildly that she would hear the elevator open and Alex's footsteps in the hall. She imagined opening the door to find him standing there, shaking his head and explaining that this had all been a hilarious misunderstanding.
but no one came. When she realized she hadn't eaten since breakfast and was starving, Hazel ordered Thai food from down the street. Gobbling it on the patio, she looked out at the lights of Hollywood and wondered how the hell she was going to right her mistake. But the more she reviewed her options, the more her situation seemed maddeningly beyond repair. Even if she wanted to run away from her problems, just get on a plane back to Seattle, there was hardly anything to go back to. She had no store, no boyfriend, no life. Now at nearly 4:30 in the afternoon the next day, practically sunset, Hazel kicked off the covers and forced herself out of bed. Still fighting queasiness, she stumbled to the bathroom and turned on the shower full blast. She shivered as she undressed and climbed in. The cool spray felt remarkably good, and she let it beat down on her while she waited for the hot water to kick in. What if Raspanti was wrong? What if she could find Alex? What if she could exploit his weakness and snatch the equation right back? But then, what was Alex's weakness? She thought back to the stories he had told her that night, of his past, of his uprooted life, of his father and mother. She wondered how much of it was accurate, and how much had been a ploy to get her to feel safe with him. The part about his mother, anyway, she knew was true. You couldn't make that woman up. Wait, his mother. Even if Alex was estranged from Paige, and even if the mere thought of seeing her made Hazel sick all over again, the woman was still a possible lead. After toweling off, she felt steady enough to dress, make a cup of tea, and eat a few bites of last night's leftovers. She took it on faith that the Thai wasn't at least partly to blame for her indisposition, but putting noodles in her stomach seemed to lift her nausea. Feeling well enough to venture outside, Hazel took one last look at the empty wall, grabbed her things, and headed to the door. As she made her way down the narrow hall to the elevator, Raspanti's fatalism was still loud in her ears. If you think they're just going to hand it back to you, you're delusional. The equation is gone. The elevator doors opened. We'll see. It was dark by the time Hazel left the hotel and drove to Venice Beach. No one was rushing to get to the ocean on a Sunday evening, and the Santa Monica freeway was wide open. Paige Severy lived in a bungalow a block from the Venice boardwalk, an odd location for a cloistered intellectual who probably hadn't owned a swimsuit in years. Yet there she was, stuck in the middle of this vibey surf community, reportedly working on a book of infinite length. Hazel found her way through an overgrown yard to the front door. The porch light was out, but she could detect an incandescent glow from somewhere within. Finding the bell painted over, she rapped on the lopsided door. Within seconds, there was the scrambling of paws on hardwood and the barking of two dogs of very different sizes. Mild scolding followed, the sound of which set Hazel immediately on edge.
"Come now, Hodge, let's see who it is. Podge, dial it back."
The door cracked open, revealing half of Paige's face as she eyed the shadowy stoop. Hazel tried to inject some confidence into her voice.
"Aunt Paige, it's me, Hazel."
Paige pulled the door wider and peered out, her fuzzy head crowned with bejeweled reading glasses. She looked down at her niece and smiled blandly.
"So it is, an orphan on my doorstep."
Hazel wondered how many more reasons she needed to dislike this woman.
"Is it a bad time?"
"A bad time for what? Roses? Dysentery?
I guess I'll have to let you in."
"Hodge, Podge, hush!"
Hazel entered the house, where the cool, salted air gave way to the warm smell of wood and paper. She was greeted by a large Weimaraner of an intense gray-blue.
"That's Hodge. The mutant is Podge."
Yapping at the Weimaraner's paws was a delicate thing with scant hair and confused breeding. Hazel feared it would bite, but she bent down anyway to pat its tiny deer skull.
"I found this guy outside just before a storm hit. Yes, you'd have blown to Catalina if it weren't for me, isn't that so? I hope you're a tea person."
"Oh, don't bother, really."
"You're already a bother," Paige snapped. "My work was interrupted the moment you put your knuckles to my door, so I may as well share my hot water."
Hazel didn't argue. A tea kettle was beginning to whistle, and the dogs followed their waddling mistress into the kitchen.
"You can have a seat in the back room," Paige called above the sounds of china.
Hazel moved down the dim hallway, discerning that the living room to her left was indeed inhospitable. She couldn't see much, but the strong whiff of boxes and mildewed paper told her that this was a repository for books. The smell instantly reminded Hazel of the gutter snipe. It was a dark, pulpy scent she had loved for so long, but for the first time she wanted to run from it. It seemed to hold all that had betrayed or hurt her, her store and the grueling business of peddling unwanted objects to unwilling people. And Bennett, the man she realized only now approached the world with a kind of stylish indifference. Was it any wonder she didn't fit into the chic lines and curves of his existence? Someday she hoped to no longer associate this smell with the ruination of her life in Seattle, and that once again the aroma of slowly rotting paper might be irresistible. She followed the source of the lamplight to the rear of the house, where what had once been a back porch was now a den. A desk stood at one end of the room, piled high with papers and books, and a sofa at the other. The sofa looked as if it had been hollowed out at the center, no doubt from having been used as a bed. Her suspicions were confirmed by an alarm clock sitting on the floor.
"Sit there," Paige ordered from behind her.
Hazel took a seat on one end of the sofa, careful to avoid the sinkhole. She straightened her spine a little. She was no longer going to be intimidated by this woman. The dogs collapsed onto a rug in the center of the room. Little Podge curled inside Hodge's legs.
"So you're here about my son."
Paige poured dark tea into both cups.
"Yes, actually," Hazel said, a little thrown.
"How did you know?" Her aunt handed her the sugar bowl, pouring some milk for herself.
"For most of my professional life, I was paid to know all the potential answers to subjective questions outside the normal bounds of statistics. Will Candidate A's smart wardrobe alienate working-class voters? Is Candidate B's corny sense of humor endearing or off-putting? Will revelations of mental illness in Candidate C's family garner sympathy or scare people off? The question here being, why is Hazel, who has never particularly liked her aunt, paying said aunt a surprise visit on a Sunday evening? Only one answer makes sense."
"Impressive," Hazel said, stifling her annoyance. "Do you know how I can reach Alex?" Paige took a seat at her desk, swiveling to face her niece.
"Alex has a habit of slipping off the grid. Gets that from me. You must want to find him somewhat urgently, otherwise you would have simply called. Have the two of you become entangled somehow? Perhaps you've developed some confused feelings for him. He's not a blood cousin, after all, and you didn't grow up together. It wouldn't be the first time that's happened in this family, but I suppose I'm straying into speculation."
She glanced at Hazel and took a satisfied sip of tea. Hazel tried to ignore the burning sensation at the tips of her ears and a sudden desire to upend the tea table and kick her aunt's chair out from under her. There was also a brief clip of Hazel emptying the contents of the teapot onto her head.
"You've really thought it through, haven't you?" "Please, this isn't a Poe mystery. It hardly requires a C. Auguste Dupin level of detection. It took me a few seconds. Most people go around thinking that life is magical and mysterious, filled with all kinds of unknowns. Bullshit. Once you decide the universe is knowable, all kinds of answers become available to you."
"I guess I don't go around thinking that way."
"Of course you don't. Very few people are blessed with a methodical brain. Like everyone else, you probably stumble through life getting into trouble, debt, and heartbreak."
Hazel had no intention of betraying the accuracy of this statement. Instead, she looked around, taking in the study as a depiction of her aunt's blessed brain and lonely life. She wondered if there might be some visible clue as to Alex's whereabouts, but on the shelves lining the room there was no evidence of family at all. No photographs, no mementos. There were only three ring binders, hundreds of them, all grimy white, each labeled alphabetically A through J in colored marker. Was this the never-ending book project? Aware that she looked to be snooping, Hazel forced her eyes back to Paige.